Good morning and welcome to Talk of Our Towns. I'm David Paul, in this week for Donna Quinn. On today's show, we're going to hear the saga of a priceless Native American artifact and how it made its way back to its rightful owners. Here to tell the story to us, Anne Castberg. Anne, welcome to Talk of Our Towns. Now, what are we talking about here? What kind of item?
We're talking about Indian headdress. It's from the Great Plains. It had 60 eagle feathers. It's a long train, and it's from the pre-reservation era.
So this is not what the type of headdress we see in photographs or movies or this. This is much more elaborate.
Well, I think we've seen similar ones in movies. But it is truly a fabulous item. It's I don't know what to say.
About what color feathers are they?
Well, they're eagle feathers. Mm-hmm. So if you picture an eagle, they're a brown feather, and then mm-hmm. they're attached to trade cloth, which was a red felt, a red wool, and the train went back about 6 feet. Right, and it had eagle feathers around the top. It had a beaded headband. It would had tie under the neck mm-hmm. of the person wearing it.
And what kind of activity or ceremony would it have been used?
It would have been used in sacred ceremonies. I guess I'm not that familiar with the mm-hmm. Indian culture. I'm more familiar with what we did in order to return it to them and their reaction once we did get it back to them. But it was a sacred object. It was what we learned when we got to South Dakota is that the headdress was for warriors. But this person also had to have a very high status in the community, because the only way that you would get an eagle feather is to have done something of significance for the community. And that could be what our stereotypical thought is of counting coup or something in battle. However, it was just as likely to be something, again, for the community, such as taking in an orphan child, such mm-hmm. as providing food for the mm-hmm. community. And so the understanding that we often have is it's simply a war item. It wasn't simply a war item. It was something of respect and something of the community.
Now, how did it come into your family's possession?
Well, that's a little bit of a long story.
That's fine. We've got time.
Okay. So in after the War of Independence in Finland, my grandmother came over to the United States, to New York.
And that was in the early 1900s.
1918 or mm-hmm. so, right, 1919. And she came over, and my grandfather was smitten with her, and he followed her over to the United States.
Uh-huh.
They got married in New York, and they moved down to Pasadena. And my dad was born in Pasadena in 1927. And so they moved from Pasadena to Chicago. And I'm telling you all of this because there's two stories about how we got the headdress. One story is as they moved from Pasadena to Chicago, they passed through South Dakota on Highway 44, and my grandparents bought it at a roadside stand. Now, that's my brother's...
That's one version.
That's my brother's version of the story. So now the correct version... So what I understood my father to tell me was that when they were living in Chicago and my dad was a small boy, my grandfather was the superintendent of a high-rise apartment building mm-hmm. off of Michigan Avenue, and there was a maintenance person. And they bought the headdress from that maintenance person.
Was the maintenance person a Native American? Or?
We don't know. We don't know anything about the maintenance person. My dad was just a tyke at the time, and my only source of information is this conversation mm-hmm. with my dad. Mm-hmm. And so they, my grandparents acquired it at that point, and then they hung it on the wall in their apartment.
And this was in the 1930s?
Right, early 1930s. Then in about 1933, 1934, my grandparents decided to go back to Finland. So my grandparents, my dad, the headdress,
All went back to Finland.
All went, got on the ship and went back home to Finland. And then the headdress was on the wall at my grandparents' home in Finland until the 1970s. And then in the 1970s, my grandmother died, and my father went back to Finland to settle the estate with my uncle. And in the course of conversation between my dad and my uncle, my dad said, well, this came from America. It needs to go back to America. And my uncle agreed. So it came back to America, and my dad had it at that point.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you come into possession of it?
Well, then when my father's estate was settled, it was determined that I was to have it. And so I got the acquisition. And so when the attorney said, you're to have the headdress.
Now, had you seen it at that point?
I really hadn't, because even though my grandparents had displayed it on the wall, my father kept it rolled up in a chest. And so it was safe in a cedar chest, an old 1800 cedar chest. But I hadn't really seen it. But the attorney said that I was to have it, and I said, well, now that's a burden. He said, well, yeah, it is. And before I got home, I knew I was going to find who it belonged to and return it to them, that's what I had to do.
Oh, well, huh?
It was the right thing to do, and that's what I wanted to do. But then I felt like I wanted the buy-in from my uncle and my brothers, because they could have gotten it as easily as I could
have. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so I found an article by Leo Kilsback. He's an assistant professor in American Indian Studies at Arizona State University, and he wrote an article called Sacred Laws of Eagle Feather War Bonnets and Repatriating the Icon of the Great Plains.
So this is a fairly widespread activity now, the repatriation of headdresses.
Well, of headdresses, it's not as widespread as they would like.
Mm-hmm.
No, it isn't. They would like it to be. They would truly love to get their items back. Just like if your great-grandfather was in the Civil War and you could get his Civil War medals,
sure,
and things,
sure,
you would want those back. If your grandmother made a quilt, you would want your grandmother's quilt back. And so this is, you know, they want it back. They want their things back. And anything we can do to get them back to them, I think, is really the right
mm-hmm.
thing to do.
The right thing to do.
And a privilege. It's such a privilege. We just, having the opportunity to do the right thing, having the item to give back, is such an overwhelming privilege. And when we were in South Dakota, I was very pleased. All of the descendants of Viola and Nils are my grandparents, all of the Finnish descendants of Viola and Nils made it to South Dakota for this repatriation. Most of the American descendants made it to the repatriation. And the Finnish relatives, they made a vacation of it. This was a once-in-a-lifetime, come to United States, go to New York, go to Grand Canyon, do all these things. And they said that by far the repatriation was
the high point.
That was absolutely the high point of everything that they did on their trips.
Now, backtracking a bit, you saw the article by the gentleman from Arizona State.
Right, Leo Kilsback.
And what was your next step?
Well, I contacted Leo and said, would you help me find who this headdress should go to? And he said that he would be happy to help me. I said that I believed it was Oglala Sioux because that's what my dad had told me. In 2007, my dad had asked me if I could find the Oglala Sioux, if I could see about getting it back to them. And I wasn't successful. I made some contacts. No one contacted me back. And so I asked Leo, and Leo said, yes, he'd help me. He said he was Cheyenne, and Northern Cheyenne, but he had Lakota friends.
Uh-huh.
And he would try to help me. And he said, be patient, though, because this was January when I was talking to him. And he said that the Lakota were very busy with the pipeline controversies.
Oh, the Keystone Pipeline.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And he's a college professor, so he's busy with college things going on. And so I told my husband, I said, I'll be very patient. I won't bug anyone till June. And so I waited until June. And then in June, I sent Leo an email and said, Leo,
haven't heard anything.
Right. What's going on? And he said, well, I'm sending information out. You know, I'm contacting people. And so be patient. So I waited until August, and because I'm wanting to give this back.
Sure.
I'm wanting to give it back in 2018. I'm wanting to get time for my family to, if they're working, to get leave from work.
Sure, to plan.
Yeah, to do all the things they need to do. And time's running short. I don't know who I'm giving it back to. I'm not hearing from anybody. I'm getting a little bit concerned. And so another roundabout story is in 2013, my husband and I were traveling from Indiana back home to Washington State where we live, and we're going through Minnesota. And I told my husband, I'd really like to go visit a high school acquaintance. She was Dorothy Anderson in north central Minnesota. And my husband's like, you're kidding me. That's out of our way. I said, well, no, she has an organic farm.
We've got to be back home by...
She has an organic farm. I think it'd be really interesting to see her organic farm. And so Russ agrees. He goes, okay, well, we'll do it. You really want to do it.
You twisted his arm.
Yeah. So we went up there and we saw her organic farm. And in the course of seeing her farm, she mentioned that her husband was Oglala Sioux.
And just coincidentally.
Just coincidentally. You know, he's not home. He's busy. He's an attorney. He's working for a land tenure that tries to return Indian lands. And, you know, I wish he was here, but he's not available. And so that was 2013, and I tucked that piece of information in my brain. Now it's 2018.
No movement.
And I've been very careful to not make a general announcement, because I had visions of people saying, oh, it's mine.
Yeah,
oh,
popping up
right.
All over the place.
So I'd only talk to Leo, and I told the family, I said, you can't talk to anybody, because I don't want this complicated. I want to keep it simple. And so now I've decided, okay, I'm switching to Chris. And I sent a joint communication saying, Chris, you know, I'd like to talk to you. Wait, I've gotten ahead of myself. Because I contacted Dorothy, and because she had mentioned that Chris...
Your schoolmate.
Right. And I'd contacted Dorothy, and Dorothy said, you know, Chris is really busy, but send me an email, send me some pictures, and we'll see if I can get him to talk to you.
No guarantees.
I heard from him the very next day. I was absolutely delighted. Chris said that, yes, he would indeed help me. He'd try to help us find who to repatriate it to, because I had originally wanted to give it back to the family.
The very family,
the descendants of whoever this headdress belonged to. And ultimately, we didn't. We weren't able to find the family. We did, however, find the right band, the right tribe, I believe. And so that people understand how did we know who to return this
headdress
to?
Yes, how did you know which tribe? There were a number of Sioux. I
mean, right.
But as you said, your father said it was
Oglala Sioux.
But how could you
be
sure?
So we believed it was Oglala Sioux, but we had no way to be sure. So from Leo's article, it has a bunch of lovely pictures about different headdresses, and it talks about the Great Plains. The Cheyenne and the Sioux are both Great Plains Indians, and the Great Plains Indians have war bonnets that have a long train behind it. A lot of Indians have war bonnets, but some of them are just crowns. They just surround the head. The Plains Indians have the long trains that go behind, that drag on the ground. And this war bonnet had the train. It's about 6 feet long.
My gosh.
With feathers along the top and then feathers along the crown of the headdress. So we knew that it was a Great Plains bonnet. Now we have three tribes. We have Nakota, Dakota, and Lakota.
And that's all Sioux.
All Sioux, part of the Sioux Nation. And so how do we figure out which of those three it is? Because we just don't know for sure. And I sent the pictures to Chris, and Chris said, how many teepees does it have on it? And I'm like, teepees? I don't know what you mean by teepees. And what the teepees are is on the headband that the crown is, that the eagle feathers go up from, there's a headband, and there were seven beaded triangles on that headband. And Chris said that the beading on that was key to who it came from. And there were 7 teepees, all of the same beading. Chris said that that made sure that was definitively Lakota, that it was the 7 sacred fires, the 7 sacred campfires of the Lakota bands. And so we now knew for sure it was Great Plains, it was Sioux,
it was Lakota.
And so now it was a matter of coming to the conclusion which of the 7 bands of the tribe.
Oh, yeah, that narrowed it down, but still.
Right, still don't know. And, you know, Chris did the work. After September, October, when I talked to Chris really did the work in terms of talking to people, giving me credibility, giving the headdress credibility, convincing them that this was indeed a gift to them, that we just wanted to give it back to them.
Yeah, that it's not, you know, what's the catch?
Yeah, because Chris had said, when he initially talked to them, they said, we can't afford this. This is more, we're a poor tribe. In fact, if you go online and look, Pine Ridge Reservoir, Reservation, where the Oglala are, is the poorest place in the United States.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And they're like, you know, we want it back. We can't afford it. And I'm like, Chris,
this
is a gift. I'm giving it back. I don't, you know, I want a ceremony, but I don't, you know, the repatriation ceremony that Leo talked about, you know, I would like to honorably give it back. That's what's most important to me, is to honor them, to give it back to them.
To do the right thing.
That's the key. To do the right thing. And that's really it, the privilege of doing the right thing, for sure. Okay, ask me another question.
So you've got it narrowed down to the 7. Which are the 7 bands?
Which of the 7 bands? Okay, so that's an interesting question, because Chris is just telling me snippets of these meetings, and then he's sending me emails asking me for clarifications, and there's... Oh, gosh, some are saying, well, how do you know it's Oglala? And Chris is saying, well, you know, her father says it's Oglala.
They say, so what?
Yeah, so what, exactly. And so you have people going back and forth saying, well, you know, it could be my band, and it could be my ancestors, and you have, you know, maybe it's not authentic. Maybe these people are trying
maybe
to...
Maybe it's just a
right, maybe
fake.
It was... Maybe it's
just put together for some exhibition or something.
Right, exactly. Because I think it was about 1933, right in that time period, was the Chicago World's Fair.
Oh, and so maybe they put it together for the World's Fair.
Right, you know, right. Maybe it was a tourist item, and so maybe this is just a big sham. And you could see where I didn't have any luck before getting in contact with the Indians was because they've been deceived so many times for so many centuries, actually, that why they didn't respond to me, you could totally understand that, because they've just been tricked too many times.
Mm-hmm.
And so having someone of Chris's stature was really
vouched
important
for you.
Mm-hmm. Really important, because a couple times, you know, I told Chris, I said, well, I'm just going to give it to you. And Chris says, don't do that. Don't do that to me. Because it, you know, it needs to be go back to the right people, mm-hmm. go back in the right way. So in any case, how did we determine Oglala? So there are the 7 bands, the Brulé, and I'd have to look at my notes to say which are the others. But what I said is that my father said Oglala Sioux. My father never lived in Sioux country. My father didn't know anything about Great Plains Indians. So if it had been another tribe that he or band he'd heard of, he would have said it was Brulé. My father didn't know enough to be confused to say the wrong tribe. Because we might say Chinooks when we mean, Chinook. I was trying to, what is the other? Anyway, we might confuse Tlingit with Chinooks on the West Coast just mm-hmm. by ignorance. And I don't think my dad could have confused it, because I don't think he knew enough to confuse it. And that was what I told Chris.
Yeah, he didn't know the names of different bands.
Right, right. And so that's, as far as my father knew, it was Oglala Sioux. And ultimately, when we gave it back, We repatriated it to a holy man, Richard Broken Nose, was officiated at the ceremony, and the ceremony was amazing.
And this was on the Pine Ridge Reservation?
No, it wasn't. No. It was at Peshla. Peshla is like the Garden of Eden. Peshla is where the Sioux Nation and Cheyenne and I believe others originated. It's in the Black Hills. And the Sioux worked hard. In fact, it was the Rosebud tribe, I believe, that worked to get the Peshla back. It belonged to some ranchers, and they had to buy the land back. And so this ceremony was at this sacred site.
Is it a mountain?
It's surrounded by mountains. Mm-hmm. There's a hilltop, and then it's surrounded by mountains, and it's
the Black Hills,
I guess. Black Hills, mm-hmm. Right. It's a wonderfully sacred spot, and we were able to be there to do the repatriation.
Now, how did it make that final step? You're saying, Chris, I'm going to give this to you and leave it on your doorstep if something doesn't happen.
Right, right.
And what was the next? How did it?
Well, Chris went to a meeting, and they were discussing back and forth, and they were trying to decide if they were going to have a ceremony, if they were going to accept it, and this and that. And finally I said, Chris, I'm going to put this in a box and drive to Minnesota and leave it on your wife's doorstep if you don't come to some conclusion. And so they met, and they decided that the Oglala would receive it, mm-hmm. because that was the best information that we had, is that it would go to the Oglala. And so Richard Broken Nose represented I believe he is indeed Oglala, but my understanding is that he was more representing perhaps the Sioux Nation, perhaps the Lakota tribe, and he received it for the Lakota.
Now,
and
at this point, had they seen it, really?
They had not seen it. And so we really wanted to be honorable, to be respectful, and so my husband made this fabulous cedar box. It's very nice, and we lined it with an elk hide, and then we presented the cedar box on the mountaintop, and it was a windy day, and they were wanting to open the headdress before taking it up on the hilltop, but it was windy, and I kind of panicked because I thought of the wind as possibly breaking a feather off. This is old. We've mm-hmm. had it in our family 90 years. And so they opened it down below, and when they opened it, they were stunned.
This was in shelter in a building?
In a pavilion, uh-huh. Right. And they were totally stunned. It was...
They didn't doubt its authenticity at that point.
Oh, my gosh, no. No, they didn't doubt the... Oh, no, they really didn't. And when they opened it, they could say, oh, this is definitely pre-reservation. It has Italian-cut beads. It has trader cloth. It has all the things that were from 1820 to 1880.
So 1820, that's almost, my gosh, almost right. 200 years old.
Right, and when you think about how long it would take to earn 60 eagle feathers.
Almost 200 years old. What kind of condition is it in?
It was in good condition, very good condition. There was one feather that was slightly broken loose. There were a couple tips of feathers that were damaged, and there were some moth holes in it, but otherwise it was in great shape. And we received a couple letters after we gave it to them, and the tribe's letter... the Troy Scott Weston, president of the Oglala Sioux tribe, said, on behalf of the Oglala Sioux tribe, this letter is to express our gratitude for your family's repatriating the 60 eagle feather bonnet to the Oglala Sioux tribe. The excellent physical condition of the bonnet is evident to the Oglala Sioux tribe that the Wickman family was very respectful and so aware of the deepest respect and cultural value that the native peoples Oglala Sioux tribes place on the bonnet. We realize that the bonnet was in your family's possession for many years, and we are thankful for the effort you made to return the bonnet to Oglala Sioux. And so that was, I mean, you could see it meant a lot to them. And then Chris sent a letter, and Chris said, I want to take this moment to relay to you my thanks, both as an Oglala, as the fortunate individual who had the honor of participating in the repatriation of the bonnet to the tribe. It was truly a remarkable thing that your family did in storing, protecting, and returning the headdress to the Oglala people. I feel blessed that I was able to play a small part in helping that process along. I thank you for all of that. Also, it meant a lot to all of us that so many of you were willing to travel a great distance to attend the ceremony at Peshla. I hope it was enjoyable for you and that we were able to relay to you how important the event was for us. To have the chair and vice chair of the International Treaty Council pull away from their meeting and join us was a surprise, but also indicative of the importance of your gift. There was, as he said, an International Treaty Council meeting, and it was at north of Sturgis at Bear Butte, and two people came from that meeting to the repatriation
to receive the headdress
when they found out what we had. Yes, and they came especially for that.
My gosh.
So it was profound.
Now, where does the headdress reside now?
Right now, it is at the Oglala Lakota College on Pine Ridge Reservation, and it's with the people that do historic preservation and study. Chris was really pleased. He said, we've just got to be very delighted with where it ended up. It's going to be well taken care of. It's going to be well studied. It's an enrichment to the Lakota people, to the Oglala. It's in the right hands, at the right place. Even if we didn't find the right family, they're the people that are most likely
sure.
to be able to find the right family.
Uh-huh.
And who knows whether we ever will be able to. But, yeah.
But it will be studied. It will be preserved.
Right.
Of course, really, it's a priceless artifact. Has there ever been a value assigned to it?
I would just have to wait to see. But I know that in Leo's article, he said that it's thousands of dollars. And he said one headdress was, someone attempted to sell him a headdress for $1.2 million.
What? $1.2
million? But that sale didn't go through. I would say I would say 10,000, 20,000, I'm sure tens of thousands. But if we were to say we had sold it and we had that money, there was no way that money was as much to us as that headdress is to them. There just is no way.
And the feeling that you got from
right.
doing what was right.
The right thing.
Doing what was right. What suggestions would you have for listeners who might have in their possession a Native American artifact like that?
Right. Well, I think, that's an interesting thing because I think a lot of the people who acquired the headdress, say my grandparents probably truly felt like it was theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They had worked for their money, that they acquired it legally.
We bought that.
It's ours. However, we're at the point where we're 1, 2, 3 generations removed from the people who acquired it. We in our generations don't have the same investment in it. So I think that if you can contact any of your local tribes, in Longview, you could contact the Cowlitz tribe,
uh-huh.
right? If you were in central Washington, you could contact the Yakimas. And I know I subscribe to News from Indian Country. You can see that the Native Americans are really working with each other
Their cultural items
right.
repatriated.
Right. Yeah. So I think you could probably contact almost any local tribe and they could help you. You could do an online search for the Indians. I'd say if I knew more, I'd offer to be contacted, but I'm...
it would probably be a detective story, but a satisfying one.
Oh, definitely.
Well, Anne Castberg, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about this. It's fascinating.
You.
And again, you did the right thing.
That's what Richard Brokennose told me when he greeted me. He said, thank you for doing this. You are doing the right thing. It was wonderful. Thank you.
And thank you for coming in to Talk of Our Towns. And that's about all the time we have for this morning. Thank you, Anne Castberg, and thank you, Joanne Rideout, for engineering this program this morning. Donna Quinn will be back next week. I'm David Paul. Thanks for listening.